outside her hut, screaming nonstop. The medic taking care of her kept asking the rest of us for sterilized water. "Please, please," he said. But there was none. The conversation went on and on like dialogue in an absurdist drama. "Water, water, sterile water. No, we have no water. Water, water, sterile water. No, we have no water." There was almost no water whatsoever for this camp of 2,000 people. In the doorway, a child stood watching mildly. The laboring woman continued screaming the same words over and over, and finally I asked one of the tour leaders for a translation.
"She say she want to die because she is in so much pain, she feel like a dog," he explained. "She say please shoot her like a dog."
Because no one told me not to, I went over and held the woman's hand. Her eyes swiveled to mine and I held her hand. Together we squeezed hands as her baby crowned. Crowning. What a crazy word, I thought, as the skull came through the widening space with its flat black hair painted onto the head, the webbing of infinitesimal veins showing, and then the shoulders being turned and eased out by the medic, and then the mother holding her own baby's hand. He had crowned, but he was no king. He'd have to live in the rat hole of Kam Chol forever. No one found sterilized water. Someone did bring a small plastic container of non-dairy creamer, though, and the mother tilted back her head and drank it. The baby was attached to her breast, and he drank too, and though I wanted to stay, wanted to help if I possibly could, the men said we had to go. It was time to leave for the Marine Press Base, where we were all promised a 4-star dinner. The rest of the tour of Vietnam was a carousel of cheerful propaganda. On a nuclear carrier, we were assured that they only hit military targets in the north, nothing more. But all of us were narrow-eyed and unconvinced. "I hope you've been taking it all in," Joe said on our last night, as we sat in a dining room drinking martinis from big frozen glasses whose shape reminded me of the inverted shellacked straw hats of the Seaclo drivers. "I've been trying," I said, looking out at the moon-bright Saigon night, the fronds shuffling together and listening to a phonograph elsewhere on the base that was playing the swooning pop song, Town Without Pity. All the American writers huddled together at this final dinner, eating everything that was put before us, the bloody steaks, the twice-baked potatoes. Some of the groups already turning experiences into sentences and sentences into paragraphs. "Joan and I are a team," Joe was saying to the other people at our table. "She's my eyes and ears. Without her, I would be nowhere."
"You're a lucky man," said Raymond, the chinless husband of Glamorous Lee the journalist.
"I found him in an alley," I explained gamely. "He was all bent out of shape, down and out." Joe always liked when I said such things.
"Yeah, she picked me up and dusted me off," he put in, "and made me into what I am today."
"I didn't make Lee into anything," said Raymond. "She emerged from her mother's womb fully formed, a pencil behind her tiny little ear."
Was that true? Could a woman writer simply appear in the world, unconcerned about her stature or whether she'd be laughed at or ignored? This one could. I watched Lee drink her martini. The glass was so large that she looked like a cat lapping from a bowl. She had never once asked me anything about myself or really spoken to me at all the entire time we were in Vietnam. She was one of those women who has little interest in other women, and whose light is entirely directed toward men. She didn't like me, and so I decided, fine, I would dislike her intensely in return. Later, in bed at the hotel, under a slow fan in the stirred heat, I dreamed about the mother and her baby in the hut in Kam Chau, wondering how they were possibly managing, where they were, where they would go. I saw the baby's head growing and becoming covered with hair. I watched the bones join at the place where the head was still soft and unfinished. Then I saw the mother and baby hiding in the trees, exploding in gunfire, and I saw their hut burned to the ground. And in the free-flowing logic of dreams, the mother suddenly transformed into Lee the journalist. She was drinking non-dairy creamer, which inexplicably turned into napalm,
In cinder gel, they call it here, as she tipped her head back to swallow. Joe and I went to many other cities together over the decades. Rome, for he had won the Prix de Rome, and we got to spend a year with our children in a palazzo, fully funded. London, because the English loved him and wanted him on their chat shows. And Paris, because his publisher there had deep pockets. And Jerusalem, for its famous book fair. There was also Tokyo, though Joe's novels were a source of puzzlement there, the translations awkward. Overtime became loosely, when a man cannot go home yet must be at the office after the others have left. And Joe himself was considered exotic. We went everywhere together, racking up mileage well before mileage counted for anything. We were globetrotters. We were international. Wherever Joseph Castleman's novels appeared in translation, we went there, dropping the children with this friend or that if we weren't able to take them along. I felt sick about leaving them and missed them badly. We'd call home from wherever we were, and the sounds of anarchy would come through the phone, making me want to return at once. Susanna would complain. Alice would cry, begging us to come home immediately. And David would say he'd just read in a book that the world was coming to an end in 5 years, and was that true? Someone would drop the telephone, and there would be sounds of shouting for a while. "They'll be fine," Joe would remind me. And of course he was right. When we returned, they were the same as we'd left them, though maybe a little more melancholy. "It lets them know that their parents have a life," he'd said. "So many kids have parents who don't go anywhere, don't do anything. At least they know their parents are in the world. I think that counts for a lot." Year after year we traveled. He gave readings. He picked up awards. He made appearances. City after city after city. And then finally we arrived here, in Helsinki. At night the shining, quiet city sometimes possesses the atmosphere of a fraternity. Young men out for the evening drink too much and knock into strangers on the sidewalk. Couples sit in cafes, eating sublime triangular Karelian pastries and drinking, and once in a while they slide off the chairs and onto the floor, where an unimpressed waiter lifts them up by the armpits and replaces them in their seats. So it was no great surprise that when Joe Castleman came to Finland, he soon found himself afloat in a pond of alcohol. The reporters who came to the hotel to interview him all said yes when Joe perfunctorily offered them a drink from the enormous stocked bar in the suite, and then he had to join them. When he went to a television station to be on a morning news show, the green room featured a lineup of flavored vodkas. The second day after we'd recovered from jet lag, his schedule was intense, non-stop, requiring Joe to traverse Helsinki and the surrounding regions, sometimes to show himself to the Finns, other times so they could show themselves to him. Wine was served at a small college in Jorvenpa, where he appeared on stage before 500 amazingly well-read students.
"Tell me, Mr. Castleman, how you would compare the teams in the work of Mr. Gunter Grass and Mr. Gabriel Garcia Marquez?"
And there was a constant flow of vodka and gin at the luncheon held in an enormous sunlit room in the hyper-modern Helsinki Public Library, with its Mobius strip design and unusually placed pinpoints of light. After the library lunch was over, Joe and I were taken on a tour of the rare books archives, and all of us in the party were fairly sloshed as we made our way through the stacks, led by a tiny elf of a woman who suddenly turned and recited from Kalevala, Finland's famous 19th-century epic poem, which the Finns say served as the model for Longfellow's Hiawatha. Finland, like all small countries, has its stories, its anecdotes, its pride, and it carries them openly. For without the connection to Longfellow, without the fresh fish and Sibelius and Saarinen, there is the anxiety that Finland might crack off from Scandinavia forever, falling into the sea of forgotten things. Beautiful Finland might be lost, like Atlantis. Like me without Joe, or so I always used to think. He took my arm now, but I pulled slightly away. "You okay?" he asked. "I don't know," I said. He looked at me for a moment, but didn't pursue it. Only later, walking back through the lobby of the Intercontinental Hotel after lunch, having been driven there by our cool, square-headed driver, Joe said to me, "Whatever's been pissing you off so much on this trip, could it wait until we're back in New York?" "I don't think so," I said. "Oh, no? I thought you were looking forward to coming here." "I was." "And?" "What do you think?" I said. "It's a bit much." "And really, Joe, this shouldn't surprise you. But it's not just that. It's everything." "Oh, wonderful. Delighted to hear that, Joan. Everything. So now I know that it isn't possible for me to set things right. I'd have to take on the entire world. While we're here in Finland, I'd have to look back through our entire history together and come up with all the things that piss you off. All the hot spots in the Castleman marriage." "Something like that," I said. And then a voice called, "Joe." Together we turned. There on a couch in the lobby sat Nathaniel Bone, the literary critic who'd been an intermittent presence in our lives for a long time. He was around 40, still skinny as an adolescent with a long drift of brown hair and pink-rimmed eyeglasses that were hamster effeminate. I hadn't heard that he was coming to Helsinki, though I shouldn't have been surprised, because he turned up at various places over the years. I've never trusted Nathaniel Bone, not since the first time I met him at our house in Wethermill, about 10 years ago. He had driven up from the city that day in hopes of ingratiating himself to Joe and being given the honor of calling himself Joe Castleman's authorized biographer. Both an unauthorized and an authorized biographer, of course, would be allowed to sit for hours with their subject, if that subject was still alive and willing, or else sit for hours in an attic working open the drawers of an old warped bureau and pawing through ancient letters and diaries if the subject was dead. But an authorized biographer is in pig heaven. He is happy. He gloats. He rolls around leisurely because, unlike his unsanctioned colleague, he can show his conclusions to the world instead of coyly hinting, suggesting, flirting about his findings and then not following through with proof. Nathaniel Bone, who'd been writing to Joe since college, had been certain that he would have no trouble charming Joe in person, since he'd apparently charmed everyone else from the moment he was born, not unlike Joe himself. Bone came from a wealthy family in California, with 2 psychiatrists for parents and college at Yale, where he charmed the chairman of the English department and was permitted to write an experimental honors thesis combining elements of history, biography, and fiction. It was this thesis that had landed him various magazine assignments after Yale. Bone did literary profiles and book reviews, commentary on different topics from both high and low culture, the kind of pieces in which he somehow managed to mention the name Jacques Lacan and George Jetson in the course of a single paragraph. It helped that he was good-looking in a lesser rock-star way, though I always thought he was spineless as a seahorse, slouching whenever he entered a room. His hair was kept long and scrupulously washed. A notable thing about him was that, though he did in fact charm people in positions of power, no one else particularly liked him. He had no time for ordinary people, and they had no time for him. He sucked up without subtlety to everyone he wanted something from. I could tell this right away as soon as he came to our house that day. But another notable detail about Nathaniel Bone was that he was the first person I ever met who seemed to understand the importance of sucking up to the wife. He actually seemed to realize that if the wife of an important man did not like him, then he was fucked. And so that first day, 10 years ago, when Bone was a younger man in his early 30s, and he drove upstate to meet Joe and formally discuss his proposal to be Joe's authorized biographer, he brought me a little gift.
"Oh, wait, Mrs. Castleman,"
Nathaniel Bone had said, standing in the kitchen. I'd just let him in and we were waiting for Joe to come downstairs. As it would turn out, we would wait quite a while. After he became famous, Joe seemed to like to keep people waiting.
"I almost forgot."
"Yeah, right.
This is for you."
and Bone retrieved from his back pocket a beautiful, hand-tinted postcard of some young woman on stage at a Smith College skit night performance in 1927. "Northrop House Follies," read the caption. "Northrop," I said. "I live there."
"I know," he said, smiling.
The postcard was in fact the kind of thing I might have bought for myself if I'd seen it in a bin at a flea market. It was a clever gift. But immediately, I didn't like him. Felt him to be an obscure threat, and was uneasy that he was inside our house, standing in the kitchen in his jeans and snakeskin boots and casually drinking the iced sun tea I'd poured him. Joe had had young men around him since his first book came out. They flitted and swirled and did a dance around him. Although along with their excitement, the men were jealous, secretly hoping to unseat Joe. Most of these young men were writing their own novels. Long, rambling, ambitious books that weighed as much as full-term infants. Nathaniel Bone, as it would turn out, had been trying to write a novel for 2 years but wasn't succeeding. His book, he himself had realized, was too wordy. Too full of ideas, a friend had told him, and this was the kind of criticism that Bone could live with. "You should definitely do a book," the friend went on, "but make it nonfiction." So it was a short leap to bring Nathaniel Bone to the doorstep of Joseph Castleman, to whom he'd been writing since college. That first letter had been addressed to Joe, care of his publisher, then forwarded, back when Bone was a sophomore at Yale. "Dear Mr. Castleman, a few of us were sitting around the lounge at Silliman last night playing Essences, the game in which you have to guess a famous person based on certain impressionistic clues such as, what animal is this person? And I had you in mind, Mr. Castleman, using the following clues. What animal is this person? A panther. What gem? Opal. Which beetle? John, obviously. What musical instrument? A bassoon. What food? A kasha knish, with hot sauce. What part of the body? The brain. What household appliance? An electric can opener. I'm not sure if any of these answers will make sense to you, but I am sending them ahead with my deepest admiration for your work, which I've loved ever since I read The Walnut in high school. With best regards, Nathaniel Bone, Box 2701, Yale Station." Joe wrote back, vaguely amused by the nerviness of this young guy, thanking him for recognizing the indisputable truth that deep within my soul, I am but a kasha knish. And that was supposed to be the end of it, except that Nathaniel Bone wrote to Joe again, this time not through the publisher but using the return address on Joe's envelope, sending him an undergraduate paper he'd written about Joe's short story, The Cigarette Tree, a critical interpretation that struck Joe as being more intelligent than most of the reviews he'd read about his work. "Look at this," he'd said to me, and I'd read it too, agreeing with how smart it was, but feeling as if the real subject of the paper was not Joe's short story at all, but Nathaniel Bone's intelligence. And then as the years passed, Bone continued to write from time to time, sending compliments and thoughts about a particular novel or story or essay of Joe's. Joe always responded with a short note of thanks. I guess I ought to have seen, back then, that Nathaniel Bone was grooming himself, aiming for some sort of special place within Joe's world. But it just didn't occur to me. I thought he was simply a reader, a fan, a distant, foppish worshipper. But he was surprisingly persistent and scrupulous, showing off to Joe with fragments of his knowledge, preening in front of Joe, dazzling him, or trying to, even as he himself was dazzled by Joe. And all of it eventually led to the young man standing in his snakeskin boots in our kitchen, roughly a decade after he'd first written that note from New Haven. He stood nervously by the refrigerator, playing with a fruit magnet, playing with his hair, trying to appear casual and confident in the home of his favorite writer, trying to impress his favorite writer's wife, and cause her to turn to her husband late that night after Bone was gone and say something like, "That boy,
The one who came today.
Bone, you mean? A sleepy Joe would reply, yawning. Yes, he's hardly a boy.
I suppose not. There's something very engaging and intelligent about him.
Joe would nod. Oh, yes, Bone is bright, all right. Brilliant, probably.
He brought me a gift, you know. A little Smith postcard from 1927.
That was thoughtful. He's a serious person, I think. He might be pretty good. Both of us would nod, picturing young Nathaniel Bone, wondering why our own son couldn't have turned out like him, imagining in a way that he was our son, the one we'd been meant to have, instead of the underachieving, angry, sometimes violent one we did have. And we'd both drift off together into a kind of placid, parental sleep, nurturing Joe's future biographer in our minds. But this was a fantasy. Bones, not ours. As much as he loved his fame, Joe didn't like to think about being the subject of a serious biography. That would mean he would have to take measure of his life and reconcile himself to its eventual end. He was terrified of death. More immediately, he was terrified of sleep, death's dress rehearsal. Other books about him had been written already. Short, undistinguished volumes published by university presses, but nothing particularly insightful. Nothing definitive. Nothing with dirt in it, with juice. Bone's biography would certainly be interesting. It would be very clever and garner the author a good deal of attention. Joe said no. The two men had gone upstairs that day at the house, and they'd sat in the study and smoked cigars. Then later on they'd gone out to Schuyler's general store and bought snowballs, and Bone had amiably eaten a pack of them, too, in a show of ritual solidarity, as though he liked them as well, as though every grown man did. They sat on the porch of Schuyler's and ate those spongy, sugary snowballs together, and Bone talked about why he was the right man for the job.
"Someone's going to do it, and it might as well be me,"
seemed to be the thrust of his argument. Lesser writers, according to Bone, would present Castleman as a one-dimensional figure, the mournful, fatherless little kid from Brooklyn who turned into a man of letters. But because Nathaniel had taken it upon himself to make a study of Castleman's work over all these years, he would be the only person able to infuse the biography with an authentic sense of who Joe was. "Like that first letter I sent you a long time ago," Bone tried, "in which I told you about the game of essences I played. Remember? What kind of tree are you, etc.? I would show your essence in the book, and your entire readership would finally understand who you really are."
It was that last comment, I think, that sealed it. No writer I've ever met wants to be understood in the way that he was suggesting.
Joe took a bite of the pink chemical pastry in his hand. I imagined there was the barest sucking sound of the marshmallow against his teeth. He swallowed and then said, "I think not." A pause.
"You think not?"
Bone was shocked that he was being rejected. He didn't know what to do with this information.
"There's an old joke," he tried. Descartes walks into a bar. The bartender says, "Do you want a drink, sir?" And Descartes says, "I think not." And then he disappears.
Joe nodded, tried to smile. He wasn't going to disappear. He'd still exist in the world even if he wasn't written up by Nathaniel Bone. But Bone had been studying the man. He'd been painstakingly writing him letters, publishing little essays on his work, and for what? To wind up sitting on the front porch of some dark, cluttered general store in a little town in upstate New York, eating pink marshmallow and coconut garbage and being told no? There was wheedling and begging. There was flattery, and then a few pathetic threats. Bone seemed about to collapse into tears, as though astonished Joe had said no, when in fact very few people had said no to him in his life. But still Joe continued to say no, repeating his answer in a good-natured way as many times as he needed to, until finally Nathaniel Bone was made to see that Joe wasn't going to change his mind. Standing up, shaken, straightening himself out,
brushing coconut flakes from his shirt front, Bone told Joe, "You know, the thing is, I'm sure I'll end up writing the book anyway." Joe nodded. "You'll do whatever you have to," he said. "We all do." Probably this lack of anxiety on Joe's part incensed Bone. Why couldn't he get a rise out of Castleman? What did it take to register on the radar of the great novelist? Bone didn't know yet that the men who own the world don't get to do that by being magnanimous and overly interested in other people. They get to do it by taking care of themselves along the way. They stoke the fire of their own reputations, and sometimes other people come by asking, "What's that you're doing there?" "Oh, stoking the fire of my reputation." "Can I help?" "Certainly. Go get some wood." Bone was furious, though he didn't show it. A few months later, he did in fact receive a large contract from a major publishing house to write an unauthorized biography of Joe. And from that moment forward, there was an uneasiness between the two men, a wariness that never shifted. A pure dislike, actually. Bone was as ubiquitous as the moon, showing up in the audience over the years at readings and panel discussions and even at the Hay on Wye Literary Festival in Wales, where Joe made an appearance. There he was in one of the first few rows with his long hair and his distinctive eyeglasses. And now, 10 years after Nathaniel Bone had stood awkwardly in the kitchen of our house, here he was, slouched against a sofa cushion in the lobby of Helsinki's Intercontinental Hotel, once again, as always, waiting for Joe. We stood for a moment, taken aback, and looked at him. "Oh, God," I whispered to Joe, who sighed. Suddenly, after the tense talk between us, there was a brief moment of solidarity. "Again with the showing up," Joe said. "Well, I suppose it wouldn't have made any sense if he'd skipped this one, would it?" "No," I said. "Go to him. You have to." "Hello, Nathaniel," Joe said, approaching with false pleasure. The men shook hands, and then Nathaniel kissed me on the cheek, and we all stood back for a "well, well" moment, after which Joe simply nodded, muttered vaguely, said, "Good to see ya," and turned away. This is the prerogative of the famous. Joe walked off without thinking he'd been rude to Bone. His thoughts were already elsewhere, on the prize he'd be receiving tomorrow night at the Opera House, and the banquet that would follow, and the swoon of attention that is everyone's dream throughout life, though most of us never achieve it, never even come close. And we feel a surge of giddiness when we so much as glimpse our own grainy image on a closed-circuit video screen in a Duane Reade drugstore. "That's me up there," we think, with a sad puff of pride. I started to follow Joe out of the lobby with a quick smile to Bone, but then I remembered that Joe had invited Irwin Clay and the people from the publishing house to come by our suite for drinks and hors d'oeuvres. I didn't really want to be there, making small talk about Joe and the award and the various events of the week. So instead I turned and left the hotel. I was armed with a street map, and so I took a walk along Mannerheim, where the shops advertised the usual assortment of delicate fabrics and Nokia cell phones as small and flat as throat lozenges. It was late afternoon, and the sky had already dropped into darkness, a preparation for the sunless winter. As I walked along, someone fell into step beside me. It was Nathaniel Bone again. He'd apparently followed me out of the hotel. "Joan," he said, clearly desperate. "Hello. Can I maybe buy you a drink? We're in Finland," he added. "Don't say no." As though the fact that we'd both come to this strange northerly country might affect my decision. Oddly, I think it did. I imagined him wandering the Helsinki streets later that night, drunk and blinking, or sitting in a bar having no one to talk to or no one who would talk to him. The Finnish language wasn't penetrable to outsiders. It was a complex collection of oral hieroglyphics, with the stress on every first syllable, and a deep mooing quality infusing most conversations. "I am here at the end of the world, and you are here at the end of the world," the people seemed to be saying. "So let us drink,
because no one else would drink with Nathaniel Bone. I told him I would.
Chapter 5. Okay, so that wasn't why I went for a drink with him. I went because it gave me a private pleasure to sit with someone Joe wouldn't want me to sit with, even though I said nothing of substance, nothing controversial. It still gave me pleasure. We sat in a landmark Helsinki restaurant called the Golden Onion. Above our heads, a slanted window looked out over the Uspensky Cathedral.
"The Onion Dome,"
Bone pointed out, but I was getting a little weary of all things Finnish. The domes, the plainer architectural triumphs of Saarinen and Aalto, the smoked fish and clusters of hard little cloudberries, the Longfellow cadences of Kalevala. We drank vodka tonics together and talked stiffly of the trip, the various tourist sites we'd each been to, the array of people we'd met here, and how different the Finns seemed to be from every other group in Scandinavia.
"They got a bit of an inferiority complex, living under the shadow of the Soviets for so long," Bone said. "That's why they had to establish the Helsinki Prize in the first place, to give their country a boost, a little jolt of self-esteem. I think it's worked pretty well, actually. Everyone here gets so excited each year when the winner comes to town, and for a few days there's all this international focus on Finland. Everyone's really thrilled to have Joe as their man, myself included, I have to admit. Look, you might think I've got a whopping case of spite and envy, but I don't, really. I don't hold anything against him. He's a great writer. He deserves what he gets."
"Oh, yes," I said. "He does."
"I wish I could quote you, Joan," said Bone wistfully. "It would make my day."
"Well, you can't."
I know," he said. "But even if I could, the inflection wouldn't be there on the page. The way you said, 'he does,' the way it makes you sound."
"How does it make me sound?"
"You know, jealous," he said, and he tossed a nut into his mouth.
In the yellowing darkness of the Golden Onion, with murmuring all around us, Nathaniel Bone and I sat with our drinks and our plates of some sort of damp, savory rolled pancakes in front of us. He looked stranger and more sinuous than when I'd seen him last. He was middle-aged now. Soon he'd be finishing the book he'd been working on intermittently for 10 years, while in that same period of time, Joe had published 4 novels. I felt sorry for Nathaniel Bone as we sat drinking in the Golden Onion. He'd been chasing Joe for a long time, and too many years had passed, and here we all were, the three of us, much older, ragged, not nearly as compelling or attractive as we used to be. Who would read Nathaniel Bone's book when it finally came out? Maybe very few people would, although his advance 10 years ago had been big, the kind of money that gets written up in media columns to show that someone has hit the jackpot in the mostly money-hemorrhaging enterprise of publishing. Because Bone's biography of Joe was taking him much longer than he thought it would, enough time had elapsed to create a literary sea change. These days, Joe was a leftover from another era, still important but rapidly on his way out. Sales of his last 2 novels had been extremely disappointing. Big writers today were different. In addition to the usual new crop of swaggering young men, there were many more women out there. This wasn't 1956, when I'd taken his fiction class. The biggest woman of all was named Valerian Connock. She was a novelist who was a member of the Inuit tribe of Labrador. She was young and beautiful, with black hair, green eyes, and sharp, bright teeth. She claimed to have grown up in an igloo made of sod and snow, though already there was a backlash against her, a bitter muttering that she was a charlatan who used her looks and unusual ethnicity to get so far, that she'd only spent a few months in that igloo, and the rest of the time in an apartment with a satellite dish on the roof. She'd gone to St. Hilda's College, Oxford, after leaving home, and her first novel appeared when she was 23. It was called Whaleskin, and was about a woman whaler and the young member of Parliament who becomes obsessed with her. The novel was as long as the Bible,
filled with arch, erudite body scenes, flights that took the reader from Labrador and into 10 Downing Street. The book was panethic, risky, maddening, and extraordinarily popular in the States and in Europe. Back when I was young, Valerian Connacht didn't exist, but now her novel was beloved. More than 1.5 million copies of the hardback edition had been sold. The back of the book featured a glossary of words in the Inuit and Nupik language. She was a recent phenomenon, and there were a few others in this vein, women who were writing and publishing in ways that struck me as masculine. I tried to ignore their work, for its very existence made me unhappy. Better to stay among the dinosaurs like Joe and Lev and the others. Better to be miserable and feel cheated than to welcome this new breed that I didn't understand and for whom I had no affection. Bone was leaning forward across the small table, his breath a warm, fermented current, saying to me, "Listen, we could talk a little bit while we're both here in Helsinki. You could tell me things. We could meet up again and you'd tell me the things you want people to know." "And what do you think those things are?" I asked. "I won't put words in your mouth," he said. "It wouldn't be right. But I know you have things to say, Joan. People have been saying that for years." "What people?" "An old friend of my parents in particular," Bone said mildly.
"Oh? Who are you talking about?"
"A woman I knew when I was growing up in California," he began. And from the way he drummed his fingers and pinched at his shirt front, I knew he was uncomfortable. "She lived a few blocks away with her husband," he went on. "He was some kind of failed artist, the type who paints driftwood. She was a shrink, like both of my parents, except she was definitely out there at the time, into all kinds of alternative therapy. But I liked her. She was one of those women from the 60s with those long dangling earrings and flowered muumuus and nutty theories about everything. She had a daughter, too. Older than me, and really dark and smart. My older brother knew her. She wrote poetry for the high school literary magazine."
"Okay," I said, ungrounded in the story, bewildered by it. "Go on."
"The woman, the therapist, had been married once before," he said, "and it had ended badly. Her first husband had left her and the baby, but she'd moved on, making a new life for herself and starting a career. The first husband became famous," he continued lightly, "a novelist."
"Oh, shit," I said. "Not this." Quickly, Bone looked away from me, as though he was apologetic, embarrassed about his sordid errand here. I felt equally embarrassed and found out. "Okay," I said finally, holding up a hand. "I get it, Nathaniel. I get what you're doing here. The suspenseful narrative, the dragging out of the story, the big surprise ending. Well, all right. I'm surprised." "I'm sorry," he said. "Do you want me to stop now? Am I out of line?" But I shook my head. He knew that, of course, I would want to hear the story of what had happened to these people. The abandoned, crazy first wife Carol, and the baby Fanny, who had disappeared into the baked depths of California.
"Carol was smart and sort of wounded, and she said a lot of things over the years to my parents," Bone said. "She told them all about her first husband and how, though she used to hate him, she'd stopped. Hatred didn't last, she said. Unless you made a real effort, keeping at it, rubbing two sticks together or something. Instead of hating him, she was always kind of amused by his success, because she'd never thought he was particularly talented. But then again, she'd always add, what did she know?"
I watched Bone as he talked. He was both embarrassed and stimulated. There was nothing particularly sadistic in his demeanor. He was just excited, like a literary detective who has found an important manuscript in the bottom of a drawer and is quietly savoring it and stroking it. Joe and I hadn't had reason to speak often of Carol or Fanny for many years. They'd faded away like characters in a novel that has become unfashionable, and once in a while I would ask Joe about them, usually about Fanny, who would be 45 years old by now. That baby, 45. Joe would shake his head and ask me not to bring the matter up, for it made him feel too bad. We knew where they were and roughly what they were, but not much more. It was as though they were permanently installed in California, the mother a therapist, the daughter a lawyer. Facts were known, had been garnered over the decades and in recent years with the help of the Internet. Face-to-face contact wasn't wanted either by them or Joe. For a long time he'd tried to see Fanny, every few years out of both curiosity and courtesy, but when she rebuffed him he was relieved. He'd visited them once, back in the early 60s during a book tour, and he had come home from California feeling depressed, for his daughter didn't know who he was and didn't seem to want to know. She'd played in her sandbox in the yard in Sausalito while he'd crouched on the green wooden edge and tried to ask her questions about herself. She'd answered in monosyllables and then finally, in the way of small children, she grew too bored and simply began to sing. The house Carol and Fanny lived in then was small but pretty, the rooms painted like the inside of a seashell. Everything had a pink glaze to it, Joe said, including Carol. And when he looked into her eyes, he had no idea of who she was or how it was possible they'd ever been married. Out of context, taken from a cold climate and transplanted into a warm one, she seemed like another person entirely, and this baby they'd collaborated on appeared distant and unknowable. There was heartbreak there for Joe to feel, if he thought about it long enough, but he decided not to let himself. He'd left that seashell house and hurried home to us. "Tell me about the daughter," I said to Bone now. "Fanny. She's a labor lawyer, we know that much."
"Went to law school at Pepperdine," he said. "Unmarried. Hardworking. Humorless, I think."
"Joe tried to stay in contact with Fanny at first, you know," I said. But there wasn't real conviction to this statement. "He was busy," I went on. "And Carol didn't want his money. It wasn't about child support. She wanted very little to do with him. And then he'd become a big deal and time passed, and we had our own family. She just wanted to be done with him." I stopped talking, dredging up the ancient image of Fanny the baby lying beside me on Joe and Carol's bed in Northampton. I'd told that baby, "I'm falling in love with your daddy, and I'd really like to go to bed with him." And then I'd done exactly that, as though it had nothing to do with Fanny at all, or Carol, but only had to do with Joe and me, the two of us floating on a tiny island, our very own Bali High. We were terrible. I was terrible. I'd charged ahead, distracting him from his wife and baby, although I hadn't been able to see any of it back then, but had only heard Joe talking bitterly about the ways in which his wife denied him love, kept herself from him. He needed sexual release. He needed relentless love. He needed a woman, but Carol wasn't that woman. I was. The wife and child receded, as though they were bit players and their moment was over. Fanny and Carol exit stage left. Carol lifts the baby's tiny hand and moves it back and forth in a gesture of farewell. "Look," I said to Bone, "I know it's a bad story. It doesn't make me look good or Joe either. But there it is. All I could focus on at that time was that Carol didn't make him happy. And anyway, she seemed crazy."
"Yeah, nuts," he said, smiling. "The walnut," he clarified. "I've heard the whole story from her point of view. She never thought she was actually going to hurt you when she threw it. She thought she'd just shake you up a little. Because the thing was, it wasn't the first time."
"What do you mean?"
"There'd been someone else, apparently, back in New York when they first got married," Bone said. "A philosophy student, and apparently he gave her one of the walnuts, too. He admitted everything to Carol when she confronted him."
"Oh," I said, imagining a truckload of painted walnuts being distributed to different women before me and after me.
"By the time she found out about you, she was really fed up with his behavior,"
Nathaniel said. I'd always thought Carol was off-kilter, but maybe she was just furious. Sorry, I wanted to say to her. Sorry, I wanted to say to Fanny. Sorry for ruining your lives.
Carol always felt mortified that Joe actually wrote about how she threw the walnut at you. But at least she felt the book was well written.
That always impressed her, said Nathaniel. We were silent for a little while, and then he said,
I hope I'm not being too aggressive about this, Joan. I was a little apprehensive about mentioning it to Joe, but sitting here with you, I thought I could do it.
It's all right, I told him. I was the one doing the comforting here.
You know, of course, I've read Joe's early work, he said suddenly. There's one story in particular that I dug up, No Milk on Sunday, from that little literary magazine. I have to say, it's not so great.
I know. Awful, I agreed, and we laughed a little.
Carol was always amazed that he'd come so far, Nathaniel said. She started saying that maybe Joe was able to find his voice only after he ditched her, or, he added, after he met you. That maybe you became his muse.
I guess I did, in a way, I said.
The blonde shiksa in Trenton, the Jewish guy.
That's me, upholding the tradition. We stirred our drinks and tried to laugh a little. We both finally let our gazes lift and looked up at the rectangle of light. We were dawdling together in some strange new way, as though we were finally comfortable with each other when, in fact, we weren't. He pushed a silver bowl of pretzel sticks toward me and I ate some, and then he said,
You could really add something to my book, you know. You'd finally get to speak. It would be a real feminist moment for you.
Oh, Nathaniel, come on. You have no use for feminism, I said.
Yeah, but you do.
In his own way, he was seductive, if only because he wasn't Joe. I was getting old, and Joe was getting old, and Bone was relatively young. And long after Joe and I were gone from the world, Nathaniel Bone would still be kicking around, getting another book contract, appearing at the 92nd Street Y on a panel called Truth-Telling and the Biographer's Task. Why not give everything to him? He hungered for it. He knew it was there in me. He wanted the Joe Castleman story to make sense, to have the satisfying shape and closure of a novel.
I won't rush you, Joan, said Bone. You can take your time. We can do it however you want. I could tape you or just take notes. We'll both be here for one more day, right? There's the ceremony and then the banquet, and you'll be completely overextended. I'll be somewhere up in the peanut gallery. The walnut gallery. We could meet the next morning, say around 10, in front of the academic bookstore. Joe wouldn't have to know. That place is enormous. These Finns read and read, don't they? What else do they have to do all winter other than drink, am I right? We could meet, and you could make up your mind about exactly what you want to say to me. How does that sound?
I shrugged. That was all I'd commit to.
I think you really do want to talk to me, he said. I'm like a therapist in a way. People have often told me that.
Yeah, but you're a bad therapist, I said. The kind who gives away other people's secrets.
True, said Nathaniel, smiling. My parents are psychiatrists. Maybe that's why I went bad. Kids of shrinks are completely fucked up from the start. We don't even have a chance.
Poor, poor you, I said.
I know you're only teasing, but if you actually knew what my life was like, you would feel sorry for me, he said. You, Joan, you've got this marriage, this life, your kids and grandkids, a house, lots of friends. I don't have any of that. I've got my work. The Joe Castleman Project. That's my life. That's my house. My kid. Too bad for me.
Then Bone abruptly paid the bill, trying to figure out how many marca to leave, how many peña, holding each coin up to the light of the sloping window, peering at it through his little lenses to see what it was and how much it was worth, though soon the euro would sweep these specifics into irrelevance. I left him there in the restaurant, frowning over a confusion of lightweight coins and flyaway paper money, and headed out into the dark evening in this Midwestern-sized city where I knew no one, and no one knew me, and people banged absently into one another like bumper cars on a wide, polished surface. With or without my participation, Bone's biography of Joe will certainly include some basic facts that many people already know. We were once potheads, briefly, in that embarrassing way of the far too old, but we never let that stop us. In the late 1960s, we were in our 30s. Picture us if you can bear it. There's Joe with a paisley scarf at his neck and striped bell-bottoms, his black hair hanging down in a long, girlish sheaf, his eyes clouded with smoke. He was always tilting back his head and applying dewdrops of Visine to those eyes back then, or else laughing over something not very funny at all. And me in my paper dress or maxi skirt and granny glasses, holding a bouquet of wildflowers. My hair was long and parted in the middle. I believe I owned 5 different shawls, which I wore throughout this time of marching, screaming, revelry, and a complete absence of irony. But what was more mortifying than how we looked was what we did. Using the durable excuse of research, Joe explored the world of swinging, a term that is itself mortifying. Où sont les swingers d'antan? If they are still alive, they are subscribing to Prevention magazine and babysitting for their grandchildren and taking ginkgo biloba supplements to restore their memories of details they probably would do better to forget. Research took bell-bottomed Joe into a Manhattan club somewhere in the West 50s called Den of Iniquity, a place with a clothes check girl, and a co-ed steam bath and a dark room where men and women lay down on plush surfaces and opened their robes to each other. I went with him there once, because he asked me to. We were still living in the village then, and the children were at home with a sitter, David watching Star Trek and the girls dressing their helpless hamsters in doll clothes, and we headed uptown in a taxi, already slightly stoned from the joint we'd quickly sucked on in our bathroom, a place the children never entered. The admission fee to Den of Iniquity was outrageously high, and Joe paid it and we entered, walking along the purple carpet as if into a bad-taste suburban home. Some of the patrons were young and beautiful, and they located one another quickly. The older, homelier types stood alone in their robes, the men as though they'd come here for a chaste steam bath, the women with a certain chin-up bravery, pulling in the soft stomachs that had long ago disgorged a baby or two, and moving their heads ever so slightly to the rhythm of the San Francisco psychedelic background music that was piped in over the quadraphonic speakers all around us. Joe and I were somewhere in the middle of these two groups, too old to be beautiful and too young to be repulsive. We entered the room with its rubberized suction door that made the place seem like the interior of a refrigerator, and we sat down together in our robes on the couch whose consistency, I would realize years later, was that of one of Joe's hostess snowballs. We were high and laughing, but the ambience was mammogram waiting room as opposed to sexual cave. Soon a young guy with a tall bong in hand arrived and all of us in the room gathered around him. We passed the bong in a circle, and I recall being vaguely disgusted by the shared spittle that is a main feature of any communal water pipe. I thought that if I was disgusted by the communal spittle of strangers, then I was certainly not going to have a big future in group sex. But the man quickly dropped his robe and tentatively placed a hand on my neck, and Joe watched as the man bent forward to kiss me, though I was a good 10 years older than he was. The woman beside me eased closer, touching her mouth to my neck. She was dark-haired and pixie-like, and could have been Audrey Hepburn's stunt double. I can't say the night wasn't arousing. It was, in the animal way that anything damp and breathy and rhythmic invariably is. The couple, whose names were Dawn and Roz, were applying all their attention to me while Joe watched. The husband's hands were large, and his wife had an extremely small mouth, which kissed me in hunt and peck fashion, as though she kept remembering and forgetting and then remembering what she was doing here. "Oh, you're so soft," she whispered, like a child revealing a secret, and though it was incumbent upon me to say something in return, I couldn't. Joe was watching. I saw him leaning back against the furred wall, nodding his head slightly in stoned appreciation. I wondered what my life might have been like with another woman, a life away from men and their caterwauling and continual need for affirmation, for stroking, as though within their minds they were always deep in the den of iniquity, always waiting with robe belt loosely tied, wanting a woman to pull it open and make them happy. Men and women drifted through the room. Distantly through the smoke I could smell a malodorous breath of anxiety, behind which someone wondered if they would find pleasure tonight, if their robe would be opened by warm new hands. By the time Joe and I left, the sun was coming up. Later in the day, thinking about what had happened, I would be appalled, forever ending my brief moment of casual bisexual sex, and my brief opportunity to imagine escaping from the man I'd attached myself to in an early fit of girlish optimism. In addition to such stories, Bone's biography will certainly include what happened between Joe and Lev Bresner on December 20th, 1973, inside the Bresners' long-hauled Riverside Drive apartment. Joe was never violent before that night. Never. Not once. I think the truly self-absorbed find it difficult to lift themselves up out of their stupefaction and inflict pain. The arguments we usually had, about his career, money, the children, real estate, and even occasionally about women, were never violent, but were often savage.
"I hate when you do this,"
Alice screamed at us once when she was small and Joe and I were in the middle of a frenzied fight.
"Can't you behave yourselves for a change?"
"Your father," I said carefully, breathing in controlled little sips, "has trouble behaving himself. That's exactly the problem." Alice and Susanna wept and begged us not to fight, and another time, during what seemed like a peaceful family dinner, Susanna handed Joe a piece of construction paper covered with doilies like a valentine, on which she'd written, "If you and Mom stop your yelling, believe me, Dad, there'll be no telling how much I will love you," which made Joe burst into tears. He stood up then and knelt down beside our oldest daughter's chair. He crushed her against him, made her milk glass fall over and spill, made her cry with confusion, and made Alice uncharacteristically chime in crying too. "I love all you little ducklings," he said. "I never ever want to hurt you. Sometimes I do stupid things. Big stupid things. Ask your mother. I'm so sorry."
"I forgive you,"
Alice decided after a moment. And then Susanna seconded it, her voice trembling. David said nothing, but just kept eating as though nothing was happening around him. I sat there thinking how easily Joe got off the hook, how smooth he was, how penitent. Across the table, 5-year-old David watched everything with the same cool, critical eye, and I have to say I admired him for it. No, Joe wasn't violent. Not until December 20th, 1973, anyway. It was the night of the Hanukkah party at the Bresner's apartment, an annual celebration in which the rooms were all infused with the smell of frying, and tiny Tasha Bresner stood in her beige kitchen, a spatula in one hand and an enormous skillet of potato pancakes in the other. She was like a one-woman assembly line, shredding potatoes and onions and forming them loosely with her red, long-ago frostbitten hands, and then dropping them into spitting oil, only to remove them moments later when they achieved an exterior perfection and a moist egginess inside that made all who ate them forget about anything terrible in their lives. The wives, biting into these potato pancakes, forgot about the infidelities of their husbands, and the husbands in turn forgot about the anxiety of the literary horse race that otherwise coursed through their bodies, upsetting their metabolism. "Tasha, can I help you?" I asked her that night.
"Oh, John, you are so good," she said. "Here, could you maybe carry this out? The men are starving. They are like animals. Oh, I hope I have enough."
She giggled wildly and somewhat inappropriately, handing me a platter. In the living room, men and women stood around various homemade, strategically placed menorahs and watched the colored candles burn down to stubs, and drank beer and wine and talked over the scratch and thump of a Jefferson Airplane album. We would soon